And I was a bit apprehensive coming, but it's lovely. And I do know many people over many years who are here. So thank you for this opportunity. I'm hoping that you'll send me all the cues if I go on too long. But what I'm planning to do is, firstly, I'll... Scott, where's the little thing? Oh, thank you. Lovely. I thought I'd do the PowerPoint first, and then I've got a little tiny kind of reflection. And I should say that normally when I present this PowerPoint, I co-present with an Aboriginal person, an Aboriginal lady. So I feel a little uncomfortable presenting it just on my own. But I hope that it will... I felt encouraged when I was reminded on the news when I first woke up that it's Sorry Day today and it's Reconciliation Week this week. I just apologise that I'm presenting it. But it's my work and it's called Helping Families Heal. And this was actually a presentation I did for a group called the Trauma Network. And so as I go through, some of the slides won't apply here. So basically, Helping Families Heal is a program that came out of my own personal work as a clinical psychologist over about 40 years. And I learnt that some of what I was doing could be useful for anybody. I was actually learning it in... I learnt it in Fremantle Prison, actually. It was a way of talking with people about their traumas and their feelings and their hurts that I then translated into a program called Childhood Issues, which was part of a sex offender treatment program. And then an Aboriginal man who did an evaluation of what was then called Safe Care said, you know, this stuff you do, it could be really helpful. Have you ever thought of taking it to Aboriginal communities? So that's what I started to do in 2010. I can't speak. Can you hear me if I stand away? Because I can't read what's up there. Oh, okay. You're taping it. All right. Okay. Well, yes, that'll be all right. Yep. Okay. That's great. Thank you. All right. Yes, but I can't see it unless I'm here. That's all. So.
Would you prefer a handheld microphone?
Sorry to do this. Yes, I'm sure everybody here. Oh, brilliant! Thank you. So basically, in 2013, a wonderful women's resource centre in Fitzroy Crossing got a grant, a domestic violence prevention grant, to have me up there 1 week a month for 2 years. And I also got some money from the Aboriginal Medical Service Yuriyangi in Halls Creek to do 1 week a month. And I was doing it for 2 years till the money ran out. And basically, it's a way of taking things I've learned, and I went up there and I said, look, this is what I've done. If it helps you and if it fits with your culture, please take it and use it however you like for your families. And if it doesn't fit with your culture or it doesn't seem helpful, please ignore it. And each time I went, people said they'd never heard anything like it before and that it did fit with their culture and it reminded them of their culture and they wanted more. So I've been keeping going since then. And in this presentation, which was in Brisbane, I was with Gloria Martin, who was working at Anglicare then as a counsellor. And this is her description of her role. And she was one of the first people to come to my Helping Families Heal groups. We just had groups of women, groups of men, groups of boys, groups of girls. And I just did the same simple diagrams, but... Gloria was a great encouragement to me because she felt that it was useful to her in her work. So that's her words. And then my background, as I've already mentioned, I started in Fremantle Prison. I worked in Safe Care and I still do individual and group therapy. And I work with mostly down here with men who have charges to do with child internet pornography or sexual offending, and almost all of them are suicidal, and almost all of them well, all of them need to work on their childhood traumas and adversities as part of the healing to help them to change. So that was the program that I took up there. And these are the aims of the program. I think it's really boring when people read out slides, don't you? So I'm not going to. And they're the aims continued of the program. And really, I worked with Ross and Gail in Bangladesh in community development, and I'm convinced that that's the only way of really working is to actually live with people and learn from them and share. And so it is a community development philosophy that underlies the program. And the method is very simple. We just provide paper and pencil, and I do my little stories. I've got five diagrams. One's called the feelings jar, one's called the child-adult diagram, and a suicide diagram, a self-esteem diagram, and a process of change diagram. So five diagrams and a life story. And this one is the feelings jar. And this is an exercise where I tell the story of how human beings bottle up their feelings. We start as babies not bottling up anything, but we soon put things away inside us and they build up until suddenly they are leaking out in all different kinds of ways that aren't always helpful. And this exercise helps people to understand. These beautiful drawings were done by boys of 11 to 17 in the Fitzroy Crossing Clontarf Football Academy. And it showed me immediately when I did my talk and did the diagram that they understood perfectly what I was talking about. And so the message is really that instead of exploding and leaking out when we're full of these things, feelings can be fished out one at a time during counselling and sharing with a trusted person, just letting it out. And that wonderful drawing of the fishing line into the jar was one of the boys, and so he inspired my idea of describing it as a fishing expedition to fish out those deep hurts. Usually people don't even know what's in their jar. It's so long ago, and I certainly don't know. But once you start fishing and asking them to talk about their life right from the beginning, their earliest experiences, out comes the grief and the pain that hasn't been shared before. After that, because often people feel a bit churned up having thought about some of the things that are inside their jar, and I don't know if you noticed, I'll just go back to that deeply sad jar in the middle of that young boy. I don't like people to feel left in that situation, so we do an exercise called Favourite Place, which, and you can try and do it if you like, which is you just try and remember the very first place where you were felt safe and happy and as young as possible. And if you remember that place, and I usually get people to tell it to me as well as draw it, I then ask people to share their favourite place. And then I ask them, and can you feel that feeling now? And of course they all can. So I don't know if you can. I don't know if you've recalled a favourite place of your childhood and whether you can actually get back that feeling. But that's the next exercise as part of this program. And these are some of the drawings that people draw, and it certainly gets them back in touch. And some people very excitedly rush off to show their children the favourite place they had when they were young. So the program continues. It's quite complicated, and I won't go into it here. But just to locate where it's been operating, this was because it was a conference in Brisbane that I had this plan of Australia, but that's where we are, up in the Kimberley. How many people here have been up in the Kimberley? Wow, so you know what I'm talking about. And I hope you'll ask questions or make comments after I finish the PowerPoint, because I'd love that. So here we are, Fitzroy Crossing from the air, Halls Creek from the air, Ringer Soak from the air. And the response that I've had has been really very moving. And so that's kind of evaluation stuff. That's not necessary. But Gloria's comments are important to me. She said she felt that using the resource book, and by the way, I didn't have a resource book, and I was doing these workshops, and some of the women said to me, is this written down anywhere? And I said, no, it's just from what I learned. And they said, well, we need it written down so we can remember it. So they actually paid for this resource manual to be made, and in it is the beautiful pictures of the that the boys had drawn. So so Gloria uses this book as well, and she said she finds it really easy with children or adults, and it's simple to understand, and it applies to everyone. So it's not an Aboriginal program, it's a universal program. I am indebted to Freud because that's where I got it from, but it's made in simple language that the men in prison taught me how to use to describe feelings and emotions, because if I tried to get technical, they'd tell me off for playing the psychologist on them. So here we are, and we talk about it, and Gloria finds it helpful because the women in their lives don't have any hope that it won't involve domestic violence. It just is something that they accept. So actually learning to work through that and express the grief and the pain and have support is very important, and to share. And this is a message I'm taking up to a women's group in Balgo. In the first week in June, they're giving a celebration for women, and I've been asked to give a talk on self-care. And the main thing I've been asked to say is, have a friend that you can share with deeply from the heart. So that's how the women really appreciate what it is. Now, these are just some pictures to close with. That's guys at Fitzroy Crossing. That's the Ring of Soak people, and there's a lovely woman called Nida, and she gave me permission, and I've shown it around everywhere, to use her diagram, and I'll hold it up. She's holding it up in that picture, one of them. When I got them to do the feelings jar, there was this sad little face inside, and I said, who's the little face? And she said, that's me when I was 7. I was really, really happy till then. And then I got taken away to boarding school at Balgo, and I was happy to go because I was going with my brothers, and I didn't realise that I wouldn't be allowed to see them. They were in the boys' dormitory and I was in the girls' dormitory. So my heart was broken, and it's been like that ever since. And then and I really loved that, because this drawing is a combination of the feelings jar and my second diagram, which is how we have to love and look after that hurt child inside us in order to actually grow. And when I went back 2 months later and we did the next stage, I said to Nida, what's happened to the little girl? And she said, she's gone. She doesn't need to be inside me crying anymore. And that's... it's the most simple but effective way of showing exactly what we're trying to do, and to help them do with one another, to share that sadness. And recently she gave me permission to show it, and her brothers were in the group that I was doing the workshop with, so they were very thrilled that they actually were there and that she had actually healed from that pain. This is at Wonka Jonka. This is what my workshops look like. I have butcher's paper and I do drawings, and I tell stories of people during the drawings, and people do their own drawings and then ask questions. That's the boys, some of the boys. They're not the ones that did the drawing. Unfortunately, I wasn't taking photographs at that stage. I just had the pictures, and then some girls from Halls Creek, and a mother's group in Halls Creek, and a healing team that was in Halls Creek. So that's the end. Can I have any comments or questions, please, just to make me relax, and then I've got some more thoughts. Oh, okay. Good, Gail.
I've known about this for a long time, and I've had one of your books and I keep sharing it with different people at the time. But I've been to different people to hear about it again, and hear more about it. And I've been to different people to hear about it again, and hear more about it.
Right. Somebody said to me yesterday, it's not an Aboriginal program, it's a program for anybody. It just so happens that the communities up there have facilitated me having that book. And Doug Bridge, my ex-husband, gives it out willy-nilly wherever, and he's been my best customer for getting hold of lots of books and distributing it wherever he goes. Yes?
You talked about running a program for 2 years until it ran out of funding. So what's happened?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yes, there was consistent funding from the Aboriginal community to do it for those first 2 years, and then it ran out, and because all their funding was threatened. And now it just comes in dribs and drabs from St Vincent de Paul and the Mary MacKillop sisters and from Halls Creek Community Shire. And so the Halls Creek community and Halls Creek Shire and the St Vincent de Paul have given us enough money for 1 week a month for 6 months to Balgo this year. So that's what I'm planning to do, 1 week a month in Balgo, and then we'll see where the next lot of money comes from. But the most expensive thing is the airfares and travelling up there, because I have to fly up to Broome and then I have to charter to Halls Creek, or and then we have to drive for 5 hours out to Balgo. Yes? That is such a good question. And, of course, when we were doing it for the 2 years, that was my sole aim, was community development, share it, find people who can do the work. And it, from that point of view, it's been a failure, because after I'd done it for 2 years, even though about over 350 people had done the program, there were only 5 people, three Aboriginal women and 2 non-Aboriginal women, who really were fired up to do the work and could do the work. Gloria was one of them. Susan Peters, an artist in Billaluna, was another. And there was a lady from Wonkajonka. And I really thought, wow, we'll need more than this. But there's actually been another obstacle which has occurred, which is that all of the women say, this is really good for us, but we need someone from outside the community, and we don't really want to have an Aboriginal person that we're sharing these things with. We need the safety of somebody who doesn't know everything about us and who will just hold that. So from that point of view, it's not been, in my view, a success. But Sister Alma, who is the person that drives me out to these remote communities, and without her I wouldn't be able to do the work, because she has worked as a Mary MacKillop nun but also as a principal in the schools for about 20, 30 years and has a very strong pastoral presence in the Kimberley. She takes me around and she actually wheels me out and she says, Christabel's here, do you want to come to group? And they all come, you know, because for some reason. I think it's because I'm not daunting. I'm so ordinary and unimpressive. I'm a little old lady, and they've heard about it, so they do come. And I don't think it would happen without that, but it worries me that I haven't been able to multiply it, and I don't actually know how to, because I have tried, apart from lack of funding, which is another issue altogether. It's this issue of cultural sensitivity, and people have a need for deep healing. They really do, and it's not something that can be easily transferred. So that's, yeah. Chris. Oh, lovely. I'm going to answer that in the next thought, if that's okay. Yes, there's one there and then one there. Yep.
Have you noticed an improvement in the moods in the communities? And if you have, has this been exhibited perhaps an improvement in physical health in people?
Sister Alma says that she feels there has been changes in the communities where we've been able to go consistently, say once a month for a year, and to work. So Mullen is a community where she feels the program has had a contribution to make, and certainly Ringasoke is another. And I haven't been to Fitzroy Crossing or Halls Creek since the funding ran out in 2015, so I'm not sure about that. Yeah. I just work with whoever I can, and in Fitzroy Crossing I did work with the men because I had good male contacts in the health team, and they were, it was harder working with them, but they appreciated it too, and so it is possible to use it with the men, but I need men to be able to do that really. And in this, we've been to Balgo twice now this year, and each time I've been only able to contact the elders. We've had about 14 men and women who come. They're the elders who are also attached to the parish church, and they've been very, very receptive and responsive. We desperately want to reach the younger men and the younger women, and there is a lot of domestic violence there, and the older people have it as well, but they very much want that to happen, and I'm hoping that they will be able to organise it, but it hasn't happened yet in Balgo, and it really is something that I have to work where there's a response and trust that they will reach out to the people that they feel can be helped with it. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll move on to Chris's question. Thank you, Chris. It's really interesting. Bevan had difficulty finding a verse, and I guess the one about that is suffer the little children to come to me, and it's the little child in all of us that I'm talking about, not particularly children, but the hurting in us as children. And but my thought for the day came from a much more challenging contemplation session that I had a month ago now, and it was this: thoughts for today. This is these thoughts. The Christian of the future will be a mystic or will not exist at all. And by mysticism, the writer means a genuine experience of God emerging from the very heart of our existence. Now, that's a very challenging statement, but it hit home because I had appeared at a panel of that Steve Hall had organised about politicians who had a faith and an explanation of how they integrated their faith and their politics. And I found myself saying that early on I used to be very happy to call myself a Christian and use that label for parts of my work, Christian Psychological Services, Christian Justice Association. But regrettably, and I think this is just me and this is in my older age, I feel less and less comfortable to describe myself as a Christian because of what it means to most people. It means something so awful that I don't want to identify with it. So this comforted me, this text, because this quote, because I thought, oh, maybe I'm not just slacking, because I know my faith hasn't diminished, but this reluctance to use Christian as a noun, I can use it as an adjective, like I wish we could be more Christian as a country, I wish we could be more compassionate as Christians in relation to refugees and all the things that we sang about today. But I find the most people don't really know what a Christian is, except some kind of tub-thumping, you know, glorifying person, and I'm not there. I don't want to be there. And one of the things that comforted me about, I said this at the panel, I said, I realise I don't use that term very often now anymore. And when I was thinking about what I was going to say today, that I wanted to put it as a bit of a controversial bit because that's the stage I am in my life. And I remember when we were in Bangladesh, we had an incarnational theology that we had to, I think I mentioned it before, become Christ and be, you know, Christ in the world. And the concept of embodiment of faith through what one's doing, so that I try and make everything I can integral with Jesus and the way Jesus worked and was and existed and exists in us. And so one of the things I've been working on is, what am I supposed to do with my faith in this life, at this stage of my life? And this is the message I'm bringing to each one of you, because it's uncomfortably all about me at the moment, but it's for an example. When I walked the Camino for my 60th birthday, this was in Spain, I had a question that I was going to ask as I walked the pilgrim route, and it was this: what do I do with the rest of my life? Because I'd suddenly discovered that my uncle had lived to be 105, and I was 60, and I had contemplated, say, retiring, doing the same thing for about 10 more years and fading away. And I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, if I've got another adulthood, you know, 20 to 60, then 60 to 100, 40 years, I will be so annoyed if I think I've only got 10 and I end up having 40. What am I going to do? I can't enter thoughtlessly into this 60th year. I have to think, do I keep my same path or do I change? Anyway, I walked along, and the first person I came across, you know, you meet at refugios and at little restaurants, and everybody says, why are you walking the pilgrimage? Why are you walking the pilgrimage? And this chemistry professor from Texas said, why are you doing it? And I said, why? But he'd already been talking to me about my work with child sexual abuse and with treatment for sex offenders, which is the passion in my life, is that our approach to child sexual abuse and offenders will transform from punitive, vilifying, demonizing attitudes of lock them up and throw away the key to compassion and constructive intervention and healing that actually keeps children safe. So that's my life's work and my passion. So I'd said this, and I'd been talking all about how I came to my theories of people being able to be treated and change their lives. And he said, oh, I know the answer to your question right now. You've got to stop doing what you're doing, which is therapy. He said, is any of this written down? And I said, no. He said, you've got to stop doing what you're doing, even though that's what I most love, and you've got to start writing, teaching, talking, and spreading what you've learnt in the last 40 years to anyone who's the slightest bit interested. So that's my new career, and I've been doing it for 10 years. I'm not as good at writing and teaching and all those things as I am at therapy, but that's my career, and I'm on that path, and that's why I'm here. I wouldn't have said yes otherwise. That I have to try and not waste the immense riches of learning that the women, men and women who've been seeing me over the years have taught me. I've got to pass that on to other people. And so that's what I'm doing. That's my latter 40 years career. I don't mind if I die much shorter than that, but I would be so annoyed if I lived for 40 years thinking I only had about 5 or 10. Because my uncle was a psychiatrist, and he retired early at 45, and then he died at 105. He was a lovely man, brilliant man. But I thought, oh, gosh, I can't take the risk. I've just got to make a plan. And there's a chart by Erikson. You won't be able to see it, but Erikson talks about the growth of the ego and the life tasks we face as we go through life. Anyone familiar with Erikson's stages? Yeah, great. It's very helpful when you're doing therapy with young people and with anybody about their childhood trauma, because the first task in life, in the first year of life, is to learn whether to trust or mistrust the world and people around you. And the next stage is autonomy versus shame and doubt, and then initiative versus guilt. And all the work I do helps people to actually come to terms with what caused them to stop trusting and what caused them to feel shame and doubt. But I'm talking this morning about the eighth stage, which is beyond adulthood into maturity. And the life task that I have, and that quite a few of us here have, is ego integrity versus despair. The previous stage in adulthood is generativity versus stagnation. And I think you're probably all grandparents and things like that, and we've all got that generational creativity. Well, I'm sorry, whoops. Oh, you're making grandchildren for somebody later on. But anyway, mine is ego integrity versus despair. And what my task is, and this is the message that I want to bring to you, is what I did was I looked back at all the things I'd done, and I have been trying to work out how to integrate and how to continue my life in such a way that it all comes together. And so that's what's happened. I've got these five diagrams I learnt from Fremantle Prison. I cart them around. I've worked through them with every single individual client in 40 years. And I do it in groups, and I'm carting it around now up north in the Aboriginal communities. And it's just my attempt to actually integrate and embody what I believe to be Christ's call of me in the world today. And so that's what I want to leave you with, is that understanding of using me as a little simple example of the struggle to find out what is me, what is the unique me, and what do I have to give, and how do I keep giving it until I'm gone and give it away to as many people as possible. So everything that I've done over the years has been an attempt to integrate my Christian faith with my psychology, and now as I share with you this sense of spirituality and mysticism as my way of embodying my faith and just living in that way. So that's the thoughts I wanted to share with you this morning. Thank you. Oh, I did have a creed that I brought. I don't know if you know the Iona Creed. I thought I might finish with that. I'd forgotten that I was going to do that. And if you've got any questions or you want me to talk about things, maybe we can do it more informally over coffee or something, because I think I've petered out of my desire to talk into a microphone. But I will. This is actually the creed that we're doing at our church this morning when we have our community service. And it is from the Iona community. We believe in a God whose love is the source of all life and the desire of our lives, whose love was given a human face in Jesus of Nazareth, whose love was crucified by the evil that waits to enslave us all, and whose love, defeating even death, is our glorious promise of freedom. Therefore, though we are sometimes fearful and full of doubt, in God we trust, and in the name of Jesus Christ we commit ourselves in the service of others to seek justice and to live in peace, to care for the earth and to share the commonwealth of God's goodness, to live in the freedom of forgiveness and the power of the Spirit of love, and in the company of the faithful, so to be the church for the glory of God. Amen. Ross? Sure. Yeah. The Christian of the future will be a mystic or will not exist at all. By mysticism, Rana, the writer, means a genuine experience of God emerging from the very heart of our existence.